Man is but a reed, the most feeble thing in nature, but he is a thinking reed. The entire universe need not arm itself to crush him. A vapor, a drop of water suffices to kill him, but if the universe were to crush him, man would still be more noble than that which killed him, because he knows that he dies, and the advantage which the universe has over him, the universe knows nothing of this. Blaise Pascal. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I hope you will enjoy this episode. To any newcomers, welcome again, and please avail yourself of our backlog of episodes. And to any returning listeners, thank you as always. I appreciate all your continued support. But yeah, let's go ahead and dive on into this week's episode, where we will continue our talk about the Ubaid, and possibly get to a brief introduction to the Uruk culture. Now, we will be talking about them next season as well, but we're going to be going over some speculation about both and discuss the Sumerian people, or at least their immediate ancestors' potential slash probable arrival toward the end of this season. But first, we will be going over again some aspects of the Ubaid culture that I thought I should either clarify and bring up some other points I did not mention. So one big thing I did want to talk about, and I kind of joked about it a little bit last week, but on thinking of it, I realized I left out a very important point when I was talking about the snake-like or lizard-like aspect to the statuary. So, in addition to kind of the bulging, slanting eyes, the heads are longer and oval-shaped, and sometimes they're stained black with bitumen. And this could perhaps have been meant to represent hair, or some people suggest it was some type of headdress. But this gives us the impression that these figures might not be human. But to the Ubaid eyes, they were not the only ones to depict people with large, oversized, slanted eyes, or coffee bean eyes, as some literature describes them. Even in the Mediterranean and Middle East, there were other times that that others used this when creating humans. I think some of the statuary from Crete, they had humans with similar shaped eyes. Of course, their heads were more normal. And that brings up, what about the elongated heads and faces? Well, the Ubaid, or at least some of the Ubaid, practiced skull binding. They would, of course, take an infant before their skull bones had set into standard, or I guess a more normal human shaped head, and they would tie it and manipulate it so it would become elongated. And we know this because we found the remains of individuals with these elongated skulls. And this is a practice that can be found all over the world at different places and different times. Specifically, there are later cases in Central Asia to the east and north of where we're talking about right now. Although, not always are they elongated. Sometimes they would flatten the skulls. I think some of the Bactrian peoples are peoples that were associated with some of the noble or ruling classes in Bactria would do this. But that's, again, that's all stuff to talk about later. Now, another aspect of this statuary that I did not get into, in addition to that, is that there was an old theory that thought they might have been depictions of an early version of the great grandmother goddess of the mountains and earth that was known and worshipped by all Mesopotamian peoples in early days. Different cultures had different names for this goddess. I believe the and you know, a number of cultures have snake goddesses associated with fertility. Egypt has three or four snake goddesses. So there was a thought early on that, oh, well, this is a depiction of a Mesopotamian fertility goddess. Though this theory, again, doesn't quite hold up, since as it was first put forward, we hadn't discovered the modified skulls. There's also a fell number of male statues with similar characteristics. So they have, you know, the same facial features, but male equipment, as it were. So rather than represent a specific deity, these statues may have represented actual people. Not a specific individual necessarily, but what a real person would have looked like, or a person of standing would have looked like. And unlike a lot of statuary from other cultures, these figures were not large and rounded, you know, like a lot of the early goddesses or potential goddess statues we've talked about last season and, you know, earlier this season. So they're all skinny, with wide shoulders, like they're usually pointed, although sometimes they are kind of curved, but they all have very narrow waists, and they're depicted standing up straight with their arms kind of, if they're not carrying anything, their arms are kind of like placed so that they're covering their navel. So this is a very different pose and motif than a lot of the other human-esque statuary that we've run into, at least so far. Another point I wanted to talk about is the rise in warfare, or rather the rise of more organized combat. I am very certain that large-scale raids or small-scale battles were prevalent at this point of Mesopotamian history. However, I should point out that this is still debated and a theory on my and many others' parts. There isn't a lot of evidence of battles between the various Ubaid communities. So combat and warfare could have been in line with what we might have seen between other hunter-gatherers or other, you know, early Neolithic societies, which we know happened. There are a lot of damaged skulls and bodies, like there's very much evidence of combat and violent death. It, of course, that there's not necessarily a lot of large-scale combat and death. These are individuals that we're generally finding. That being said, there not being a lot of evidence doesn't mean that there isn't any evidence. One thing about archaeology, it's great at finding evidence of people or events happening quite regularly at a single place over a long period of time. However, it is very difficult to find, especially the further back you go, singular evidence of one time or once in a lifetime or once in a century or however you want to describe it, event, at least when it relates to people. You can find layers of destruction in cities. There are, you know, plenty of examples of archaeological evidence of a site saying, okay, this place was destroyed at around this time period. We see all this evidence of fire or a flood or an earthquake or something that contributed, you know, to a layer of destruction. We haven't found too much of that, especially the larger sites of the Ubaidian period. But you have to remember, maybe destruction wasn't the primary goal. If it's a raid, it may be, oh, we're here to just steal food. We may not have to destroy a place. If you're raiding people regularly, typically you want them close by, so you can continue to raid them. There also may have been the goal of enslaving people or capturing people to trade for other goods or to, you know, trade for other individuals that maybe they had captured. As we'll talk about with the rise of urbanization, there is a constant need to get your pop, you know, to get certain amounts of people to continue to work your industries and to expand your economy and, you know, other things too. So it's very possible that, you know, warfare was also maybe formalized at this point in time. We will see in other areas of the world that early warfare is actually done kind of at a relatively small scale, but there are rules set out, and this might be an example of maybe champion combat of one or a small number of individuals, or, you know, maybe a couple hundred individuals coming together, agreeing to fight an equal or close to equal number of individuals from another settlement, and maybe even a third settlement, kind of observes and then makes a ruling. Okay, these people won. They're in the right. The gods are with them, or the spirits are with them, what have you. That type of combat does not, you know, lend itself to burning cities down. In fact, it's designed to prevent destruction, large-scale destruction of cities. We see things like the Flower Wars in Mesoamerica between the Aztecs and others. I think early Greek city-states, or at least small city-states, or in the early periods of history, this changes later on, of course, but they would, you know, all right, it's summertime, we need to, or, you know, it's early spring, we need to get this dispute taken care of, this land dispute. Let's go ahead and get our citizen hoplites out in the field, and let's push each other around and see who gets pushed back more. That happens. That is a recorded event. So it would not surprise me for a, you know, group of individuals to, you know, implement something like that. Also, we begin to see more, I won't say advanced weaponry, but we begin to see an expansion of material used to make weapons. I think even for the Ubaid period, there are examples that we have found, not a lot, but a few examples of arrowheads or spear tips made of copper, of actual metal. Now, as we'll talk about later, copper is not necessarily the best material to make a weapon out of, especially when you start talking about bronze. But it might not be any better than like some other stone you could make. I mean, you really don't need copper to kill a human. You can do that with, you know, hardened wood and sharpened wood, or stone. Can kill you just as well as copper. But, you know, a prestigious warrior, he might want to say, hey, I've got this shiny spear, follow me. So there is evidence, maybe not directly, but there is evidence that warfare is becoming more important to these societies, or at least more common, if not more important. Also, we have found evidence, and this is further north. I think it's right around the modern Turkish-Iraq border, and I forgot to write the name of the town down. Or the name of the site down, but there is evidence dating to the Ubaid period in northern Mesopotamia, which, again, is only around 1,000 years or so, give or take, where there were, I believe, 22 male individuals who were killed. At least it appears they were killed violently, and they were, you know, buried in a group grave. So this may have been a type of honorable burial for soldiers, or, you know, defenders or warriors for a specific village. I wish I had read that. I'll have to look that up, and I'll try to remember to get it for next time. But, so yeah, that's my opinion on the matter. Warfare has to come about sometime, and it shows up very early in the written record, and it's when it shows up in the written record, it's fairly advanced. We have, if not large armies, then still very organized armies, or very organized warriors. Army might not be the right choice, but that's all stuff we'll talk about later. But I did want to bring that up because I did make it seem like it was definitive that, you know, raiding was being practiced last time. But that is my opinion. That is my opinion based on reading and, you know, my general understanding of history and human nature. But my opinion could be wrong, and my understanding of those things could be wrong. So I did want to just throw that out there and give my reasonings why I think that is the case. But that is not 100% agreed on. And there are those that think there's not any need for that yet, at least at this period. That's something that they would think would rise later. And it certainly does arise later, or at least continues later, if my opinion is correct. But one of the things on this show I want to do is I do want to give a number of views on a number of subjects. I don't want there, especially when there's not any concrete agreement, I do want to kind of give everyone the full conversation going on about a specific topic. And of course, you're welcome to make your own decisions and read on your own. I wouldn't begrudge you that. And maybe you'd find something that's like, hey, you should read this. That's kind of contradicts what you're saying. And I would be very interested to hear that. So please do. let's see. Statuary, combat. Another topic I briefly mentioned last week when talking about the Ubaidians was language. Fairly early on, after Sumerian had been deciphered or was in the process of being deciphered, a number of people noticed that, well, hey, some of these cities, their names, rivers, things mentioned by the Sumerians don't seem to be Sumerian in origin, and they're not Semitic. Those were the two languages, you know, first kind of thought to have been spoken in the area. Akkadian first, which is an Eastern Semitic language. And then, you know, as they're beginning to understand these things and reading the written records, they're like, well, wait a minute. This doesn't sound like it's Akkadian. This isn't a Semitic word. There are other Semitic words for these things. Or... this river, this name is not Semitic. This name isn't Akkadian. So maybe there was an older culture. And then, of course, they found, you know, evidence of the Sumerians. And it took a while, but once Sumerian was deciphered or translated, however you want to describe it, they discovered, okay, well, yes. And so they spoke these words, all right? This is their language. This is this. Well, what came before their language? And then they started looking at other items, and they're like, well, wait a minute. Some of these terms aren't even Sumerian, so there must have been a language before them. And I know some of you are asking, well, wait, how do they know something isn't Sumerian, Semitic, all this stuff? Well, we've talked about linguistics. I'm not the most linguistically inclined person. But, you know, there's a lot of different Semitic languages that are still spoken. We have evolutions of how their language and writing has evolved. And, you know, you're able to kind of back trace things. Sumerian's a little bit different. But Sumerian is a fairly straightforward, I think, in terms of it's very monosyllabic. Almost all of their words are one or two syllables. It's also an agglutinative language. So anything that is not that, you would think, okay, well, maybe it's Akkadian. Maybe it's a Semitic language. Well, no. The Akkadian for this is this, and the earlier form of Eastern Semitic, the Akkadian descended from, was probably something like this. So there are these languages that we're not quite sure their origin. In fact, some of these are very common terms. Farmer, smith, carpenter. These are all trades, and that would have been him practiced fairly early on in proto cities, and cities themselves, of course. So they must have existed when the Sumerians and the Akkadians are moving into this region. This has been put forward by a couple of people, though there are some disagreements on the exact theory that there was a Proto-Euphradian language. It would have been spoken by people along the Euphrates River initially, although obviously they don't know that it originated there. That's just where they believe it would have existed. Due to the rise of the Samara and the Ubaid cultures, there is some talk that the people of those cultures would have spoken the same language, or the proto-language maybe have split somewhere in between those cultures, and that these people were speaking sister languages. There are certain place names that, again, were not Sumerian. Some of the first big cities were not Sumerian names. And we'll talk about that shortly. So there is evidence that there was a language that the Sumerians were familiar with, at the very least. It may have still been spoken in small pockets when the Sumerians began to invent writing. That is something. There's also I think it's called the banana language. This is a term devised by Dyakonov and Ardzinba, I believe, are the names of the linguists that came up with it. But this is a characteristic of replication of syllables. And we see this in myths from later periods. The goddess Inanna, Humbaba is another. Pazuzu is another language. So these names and things like that may have even been adopted by the Sumerians at later periods, or were spoken by the descendants of the Ubaidian and Samara cultures, who were kind of eventually absorbed into the Sumerian civilization. One thing we'll continue to talk about when we get to urbanization, and again, we're going to talk a bit more about this even later this episode. You have to live with your neighbors, especially in cities where, as time has gone on, you're not related to everyone anymore. You're bringing in people, or people are coming to you to live the same type of lifestyle. Now, you might be more important, you might be less important, but you're all living in the same general community. So if you want to survive, you do have to contribute to a village or a town's industry in some way, so you can either produce food or provide labor that is sufficient enough to earn you food. It's very possible that the Sumerians, when they were moving into the region, they were attracted by the abundance of the Ubaidian people, and then perhaps the Sumerians, along with a couple of other other groups that we don't have a record of, kind of developed their own culture. Or maybe the Sumerians weren't a single people. Maybe they were several people who moved in, and they were outsiders to the Ubaidian, and then they adopted this kind of general Sumerian identity later. That is a possibility. But I wish I was better at linguistics so I could explain it better, but that's just kind of a very simplified overview of that theory. There's also the theory that the Proto-Euphradian was like a break-off of early Indo-European or Proto-Indo-European. No one buys that. or at least I should say that is a very, very majority view, or a very, very minority view, excuse me. I think that's kind of been disproven, but I could be wrong. At least from what I had read, that doesn't seem like it has much support by any major linguistic scholars today. But kind of going back to that kind of building of a community not based on blood or kinship, this is a good point to bring up the burial practices of the Ubaid, which I didn't really go over, I don't think, last week. But early on, or at least the earliest that we've found for the Ubaid, I don't think we have Ubaidian burials before the Ubaid III period. But very early on, all of the Ubaid peoples, adults, infants, are buried together under homes in that family setting. And they're buried whole. Their bones aren't destroyed. They're not burned. They're buried as they are. They're all given grave goods of some type. Some of them are painted with red ochre, which is a very old tradition in a lot of different areas. That's like one of the oldest burial traditions we have as a species. But they also would, it appears, be buried with pottery that was probably filled with food. So they were given food for the afterlife. However, as time goes on, these burial practices change. The adults are no longer buried under the homes. They are buried on the outskirts of settlements, kind of on the boundary. And they were, you know, they were still buried whole. They were still given grave goods. Sometimes they would be put into pits, like pit burials, or they would be placed in clay boxes, kind of a proto-coffin. But they would be buried in kind of a communal burial ground. It's not like a single plot. There are usually a couple of people fairly close together. But infants were buried, or were continued to be buried in the walls of larger dwellings. So this could have been a means to, get several groups to kind of, share communal space in terms of the afterlife. Hey, your dead are buried on the perimeter of the village, and they're buried in the interior, the same as my ancestors. They're not just buried underneath homes. So maybe the infants were continued to be buried under their homes for the family to kind of watch over them, their spirits in the afterlife, whereas the adults, they're surrounding the settlement. They're making it a shared land, perhaps, that you would have to, as a group, defend. That's one theory I've read. Shows how over time, the Ubaidian people are changing their burial practice, their spiritual practices, their religious practices, and this could have, could be a sign, at least if that theory holds true, that, they are welcoming more and more outsiders in, or more people are deciding to move to a town or a city. This could be a stage of urbanization. Now, another change that I don't think I mentioned much last time, in terms of food production, of course, farming, we know how important that's becoming. Of course, there were absolutely herd animals that the Ubaidians used. As you might imagine, due to them being in marshes and along rivers, fishing was also important. There is also evidence that the Ubaidians may have been the first people to develop larger reed boats for fishing. They're still not massive, obviously, But, you know, they're made to be more comfortable if you're going to be staying on them for a few hours. Though, there is, again, some debate on that. This could have come about during the Uruk period, which is following the Ubaid period. But it is a possibility that this began to happen. Fishing is still being primarily practiced in shallow waters, though there have been tuna found, like tuna bones found at a couple of Ubaidian sites. And those you have to kind of get out a little bit further. I think, at least in modern day, maybe in the past they were easier to catch. But this is possibly coming from around the coastal region of what is now Kuwait, maybe Saudi Arabia. So this could be an evidence of long-range trade. Another idea that is coming about is it's possible that sheep finally are being bred for wool. This is still debated heavily as well, but it's very possible that the sheep that have been, you know, at this point we've had sheep for about, at the end of this season, what, 4,000-5,000 years? It's possible now that they've developed enough through selective breeding that they have enough wool that they can be plucked, at least, for small amounts of wool, which could be turned into type of clothing. Probably for trade. I don't think wool would necessarily be the best material for where they're living, but, you know, there are other things you can make with wool, not necessarily clothing, but, you know, it's, you know, there are uses you can make for it. And this kind of ties into a little bit of what we've been discussing. Sadly, we don't have any DNA that can be dated to the Ubaid period in any region where they are thought to have existed. We have, you know, some from the periphery of the Ubaid, but those all date to prior to the Ubaid being in the region. But it does show links to either the Caucasus or the Iranian plateau or along the Mediterranean coast. So it's hard to say exactly who the Ubaidian were related to, and, you know, how closely related, all that kind of stuff. But that is kind of where I think we can leave off with the Ubaid for this season. Very long lasting culture, very important culture in terms of their innovations, or at least the starts of innovations that they made. They were very successful. Obviously, their pottery was very widespread, as we discussed last time. And they were a very productive people. And this success probably drew in a lot of outsiders. Again, we know that their aspects of their lifestyle migrated out. So it's no surprise that maybe people drawn to them in their lands might start to adopt some of their traditions, while maybe keeping their own or advancing their own. And that will bring us to the Uruk period, or the Uruk people. Now, I'm not going to go into super detail on the Uruk. This is something we'll talk about next season, because the Uruk period, depending on your dating, can start right at 4,000. It probably had its beginnings earlier than that, but the name comes from the city of Uruk. No surprise there. Now, the Uruk were probably the Sumerians, who were, I believe, at least moving in, or at least had large-scale contacts with the Ubaidians during, I would say, at least the last 500 years of this season, 4,500 to 4,000. It's possible they were there longer, it's possible they were shorter, but I don't think by much. Now, where they're coming from, we don't know for sure. This is something that we will talk about very in depth later. But the Sumerians have their own mythology, and they acknowledge that they were not initially from what we will call Sumeria. They came from a land known as Dilmun. Now, I mentioned Dilmun in our episode on Arabia. It's believed to have been an island kingdom, or at least, you know, a city built on an island or near an island or near the ocean. And there is a historical place known as Dilmun. We still don't know where that historical place was. But there's also the very real possibility that Dilmun, the mythological Dilmun, was not actually the historical Dilmun. As we'll talk about when we get to Sumerian historical records, there are mentions of places that kind of shift over time. They might think that something is there, but then later on, you know, it turns out to be somewhere else. Or the meaning of the name shifts. And of course, why that happens, we'll get into when we get to, again, the historical periods. But that is something to keep in mind, especially with these very early written records. The Sumerians, again, they made no doubt that they were not from Sumeria initially. They arrived after the flood, and that is, of course, the Great Flood. One thing I didn't mention when talking about the discovery of the Ubaid period last episode, Leonard Woolley, when he first excavated the region, the couple of places he excavated, he found evidence that there was a very large flood that happened in the area. Now, you have to remember, this is the early 20s when he made this observation. Now, since then, we have learned that, well, wait a minute, this wasn't a flood. This entire area was at one point a marshland, or at least mostly marshland, probably not entirely. But so he didn't know that. The environmental sciences weren't quite as advanced as what, you know, we have now. We've made a lot of progress when learning about geography and geology since then. But that is not to say that there were not floods or a flood in the area. There were probably a lot of floods in the area, as a matter of fact. There were probably some very bad ones. Probably not the universal flood that shows up in the myths, but you have to remember, over time, you know, stories get elevated, they get exaggerated for dramatic effect, or to make them more interesting, or just to kind of seeing is believing, and sometimes you have to make a story seem larger than it was, just to convey how devastating something was. So maybe the universal flood wasn't universal, but, you know, it was probably very bad. In fact, there were probably several really bad floods. And if the Sumerians did come from an island, which, for those wondering, Dilmun, we don't know exactly where it is. There are several theories. There are some that believe it was maybe near modern Bahrain, one of the chains around the Eastern Arabian Peninsula. There are some thoughts that maybe they were coming from the coastal region of what is now Iran. There were probably some floods there. Or maybe they were actually, you know, on the coast of the Persian Gulf. And as the sea levels rised, they had to move inland a little bit more. Sadly, we do not know. But again, there was a historical kingdom in Dilmun later, but that is for, we'll talk about that more when we get to the historical period for the Sumerians. But there probably were several floods, probably devastated the region prior to our season and, you know, during and after our season. The only reason I bring this up is because the Sumerians had five cities that they considered older than the flood. They were the antediluvian, which just means before the flood. There were five antediluvian cities, and they were the oldest in the world, and they existed afterwards. Now, I've been going back and forth on this because, again, the Sumerians are not, they're not necessarily there this season, but I have no doubt that they definitely included some aspects of their neighbors' myths, because they probably shared some similar trials and tribulations. So I am going to be doing a kind of a brief Sumerian mythology episode the same way I did with the Egyptians, even though maybe a little bit out of order. But I just want to kind of put that out there. But the according to the Sumerians, the five oldest cities were Eridu, Uruk, Bagdabira, Nippur, and Kish. Now, there is also the city of Ur. And depending on the tablet you're reading, Ur is sometimes on that list of the five antediluvian cities. It changes over time, as does the Egyptian mythology. But another thing I'm going to be talking about next week is the Sumerian kings list, which we'll be going over that as a source, why it's used and its strengths and weaknesses as a historical source, because there is some fantastical information, but it also purports to cover the period of time that we're talking about this season. Of course, it purports to cover a period of time well before this season too, and I haven't brought it up before then, but we're close enough to its beginnings, or at least the, I guess, where the cities are being founded, that I feel like now's a good time to include it. So I hope you're looking forward to that next week. I've just listened to a couple of books on Sumerian mythology to get ready for this week. One is a little bit older than some of the others, but it's interesting to see how our understanding of Sumerian records has changed over the decades. So, but that's something we'll be covering next week. This episode was a little bit longer than I was planning. I hope I can get it rendered out and posted for regular time. But if you guys have any questions or feedback or comments or constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me at war@revpod@gmail.com. You can comment via YouTube. I'll have a link to the YouTube episode in the description on all the audio channels. You're welcome to drop by there, leave a comment, and ask your questions there or post your links. If you have free time and you're on YouTube and I'm live streaming, you're welcome to drop in the chat there and say hey and ask questions. You can't post links there because YouTube doesn't allow that. You can also direct message me on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it. So I will be open on all those channels. And I like to respond as quick as possible, though sometimes it may take me a day or two in some cases to see those comments. But feel free to drop me a line however you'd like. Thank you guys for all the support recently. I had one day this week I had over 140 downloads of the audio podcast. The Ubaid episode on YouTube took a little while, but it eventually got over 50 views there too. So over 200 downloads for that one episode, or views or whatever you want to call them. So please keep listening, keep liking, keep downloading, keep commenting on all those forums, however you'd like, because it's helping the channel grow. I'm really, really pleased with all the support. So thank you all again. I hope you have a good day and a good rest of your week whenever you're listening to this. Thank you all. Have a good one. Peace.